Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show because I am joined for a discussion of David Cronenberg's Existenz by the demoness Kate Cannon.
I am so excited to be here.
I am very excited to have you here on the first, I guess, official podcast you were on during our podcast marathon, but this is like the first episode proper that you're going to be on. And we were commenting before we started recording that we were both excited because we had no technical difficulties this time out.
None. We're keeping it real proper. I'm into it.
That's right. Well, that's because we're now using computers made of bones and teeth. And they work so much better.
Oh, and they bleed. It's so weird.
And they bleed. Hopefully everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, those of you who celebrate Thanksgiving. We are already gearing up for like the end of the year stuff. I can't believe there's only a few weeks left in 2016, which means we're going to be starting with our, you know, best of the year episodes and our overrated, underrated stuff. And there's a lot of stuff I still need to see before we are able to do any of that. But it's a fun time of the year on the site, so I am excited about that. I have a question before I ask you, Kate, what you've seen lately. Do you listen to a lot of podcasts or not very many?
I am constantly consuming media, so yes. I listen more often to podcasts than I do to music.
Okay. I think that's where I'm at now as well. So let me ask you this, because this week I've been listening, checking out a few like new podcasts or new to me podcasts. And the thing that I noticed that they have in common is that they're all very produced. Like there's clips from, you know, a lot of these are movie related or even horror movie related. They'll drop in clips from movies or like little breaks, songs, different like voiceover things. There's a lot of production going into these, and our show has never been like that. There's the goofy little 8-bit theme song at the beginning and the end, and otherwise it's just we press record and we talk for an hour. Where do you land on like the, are you a fan of the ones that have, I guess what I'm asking is, do we need more production? Like, are you a fan of the podcasts that have a lot of production?
I am not. I like my podcasts like as close to a train wreck as possible.
then you are on the right podcast.
That's how I found you guys, JK. So like one of my favorite podcasts lately, which is just like streaming hilarious information into my brain as fast as possible, is like My Brother and Me, which is just three dudes. They're brothers, obviously, or that would be a weird title. Just shooting the shit for an hour. And that's it.
Okay.
And it's hysterical. Like I have had to like calm myself down at work laughing.
Wow. All right.
Because I think with like, I mean, I love NPR. I love a good amount of production, but I think that it's just like not what I want, I guess, from a podcast. Cause I like just like listening to people talking and it not being like, and now like a, you know, let's talk about Squarespace kind of thing. It's just a little fake to me.
Yeah, I mean, the ads are one thing, and there's a few podcasts I listen to that have, you know, an ad at the beginning and then an ad about halfway through, and that, you know, whatever, they pay the bills. I don't know, I guess I'll put it, this is a mistake to put it to the listeners, not that I don't love the listeners, but anytime I put something to the listeners, I get wildly different opinions, and things just stay the same because I'm like, well, I can't make a decision. Some people are like, yeah, more production. Some people are, no, just leave it the way it is. And then I say, well, I'm paralyzed with indecision and nothing changes. But I'm just curious if you guys want to comment underneath this episode. Do we need more production? Would that help the show? I don't feel like it would. We've been doing this for 6 years. Like, it is what it is at this point. But I listened to some of these other ones and I'm like, well, maybe they seem way more professional than we do.
I think the only thing that could make it better is if you do one whole week of episodes that, or week, what am I saying? A month of episodes that are just like Morning Zoo. But I think beyond that, everything is fine.
Do you want to start with this one?
Do we have sound effects?
I don't know if we do,
like
but
a
I can.
squishy gross sound effect to start?
Yeah, I could find a kazoo and like a bicycle horn. That might help.
Oh my gosh. You know what? I don't think I'm emotionally prepared for this like set change, but I'd be into it in a future show.
All right, maybe this is something we launch in 2017. Just pure morning zoo F this movie. All right. Well, I'm curious to hear what people have to say. And in the meantime, Kate Cannon, have you seen anything good lately?
Patrick Brownlee, I have rewatched a lot of favorites just to like, I don't know, surround myself in a cozy tapestry of movies that I love. The new one that I saw is I saw Moonlight in theaters and it was so beautiful. It's just like overwhelming. So I recommend if it's playing around anyone, I don't know if it is. I saw it at like one of those, like, I don't know, seats 30 theaters. I would hugely recommend seeing it.
I'm definitely going to see it this week. I have not yet, but it's like in the top three that I need to see. So
it's a game changer. It's a game changer. I think it is now my favorite movie I've seen this year.
Oh,
I've
that's awesome.
So sorry, Green Room. Move over for Moonlight.
That's right. Okay.
And then I like rewatched Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, that like Katie Holmes joint with the little girl that looks exactly like her.
Yes.
Which I find weirdly comforting. I think it's a comfort movie. I don't know.
Isn't there a tooth thing in that movie too?
There, you know what? I'm seeing a theme. my name's Kate Cannon and I like teeth. Yeah, there is a tooth theme. It's sort of like the dark sort of Germanesque approach to the Tooth Fairy, which is like cool and cute. I saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers for the first time not too long ago.
This is the Philip Kaufman one, right?
Is that the one with Jeff Goldblum in it?
Yeah.
Yes, then that was the one that I saw. And that movie should just be renamed Listen to the Women in Your Life. And that should be it. And then...
Did you like that movie?
I did. I think that it was something where like I was expecting it to be funnier than it was. I don't know why.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know what that's based on.
I think it's just because I've seen that movie in like reaction GIFs because I am a child of the internet. Like that last scene is like a reaction GIF for like things that I would normally think are funny. I don't know. I guess I was expecting it to be campier than it was. But it was good. I liked it a lot.
Are you able to make sense of the little like dog with the person face?
Oh my gosh. I feel okay. No, but I can try.
Well, it's so like it's nightmarish and it's even more nightmarish because there's really nothing else like it in the movie.
But weren't there some pods like okay, if you saw two pods next to each other, Was that the one where they like tripped over them? I feel like because if you crushed a pod but only half crushed it, I don't know, maybe they like zhuzhed themselves together and were like, cool, this is now one pod that functions.
Maybe.
I don't know how else. I think his name is Banjo. I don't know.
The dog with the person face has a name?
The man-faced dog, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
This is what I have heard.
Banjo the Man-Faced Dog. He's going to be one of our first guests on the Morning Zoo edition of F This Movie.
I know a guy. You need the connect. So no, I can't make sense of any of that. But I'm never one, like I don't care to make sense of things, I guess. It's just like that whole movie washed over me and it was like very 70s and it was cool. Or whatever year. I'm so young. And then the last movie, which is honestly one of my favorite movies of all time, 100% unironically, is Monkey Bone.
Okay.
Which is, I think, one of, like, well, poor Brendan Fraser, like, was in four movies. It was, like, Bedazzled, Encino Man, and Monkey Bone. And he just totally fizzled after that. But Monkey Bone, I think, it's actually a very good movie.
I have tried a number of times to, like... go back to Monkey Bone thinking it's a secret success. And I'm not there yet. I haven't arrived there yet. Although the DVD has not the alternate version, right? You don't know because you don't own DVDs. Shoot.
I know.
I can't remember if the alternate version is on the DVD or if it's just Henry Selick talking about, because he made a completely different movie that then was taken from the studio and recut and totally changed.
I did read an interview with Rose McGowan who said that, like, the original was apparently much better.
Yeah, it was, I think, darker and even weirder, if you can believe that. I haven't seen Monkey Bone in a long time, but I am fascinated. I remember seeing it opening weekend theatrically, and it was myself and Erica and like a theater full of high school kids who came right from a formal dance. And I thought, what an interesting choice to leave your formal dance and go see Monkey Bone.
I would have 5,000% left any of my proms to go see Monkey Bone in theaters.
I'm fascinated that you love Monkey Bone.
It's goofy. I mean, it has Chris Kattan like throwing organs like ninja stars. Like, I'm into all of this. what have you seen lately, Patrick?
What have I? Well, nary a Monkey Bone.
Shame.
Right? What have I seen? Okay, so I saw Manchester by the Sea.
I have heard good things.
Yeah, I believe just today the National Board of Review, whatever that is, named it their best film of the year. It is the third film from Kenneth Lonergan, who made You Can Count on Me, which is great, and Margaret, which is great, and Manchester by the Sea, which I guess is great. Well, it's one of these movies where, like, I don't have anything bad to say about it. I just didn't really connect to it. I like all the performances. Everyone's really good in it. It's very sad. It's about, you know, broken people trying to live their lives. And gosh, who doesn't want to spend 2.5 hours with that? And it's I like that his movies are very much about the messiness of real life. There's no like clean, you're good, I'm bad, or we had this disagreement and I was right and you were wrong. There's none of that. It's just people trying to sort of navigate weird everyday difficulties. And, you know, sometimes it involves real trauma in the past, but, you know, that kind of informs their day-to-day lives. I will say that the film involves Casey Affleck and like a high school. He's looking after this high school kid who's his nephew. And any other movie would have had this high school kid be like this brooding, damaged asshole based on things that have happened to him. And this kid isn't. He's like a normal kid with a sense of humor and a life. He plays in a band. He dates multiple girls. He's flawed, very flawed. You know, everybody in the movie is very, very flawed. But I like the fact that there's something that just felt more realistic about it and less movie-ish. So it's a movie that I have really only good things to say about. And yet, at the same time, I'm just kind of like, maybe it's not for me.
I kind of just got like, I mean, I'm not about to review a movie based on a trailer, but I just got like overwhelming Irish Catholic vibes from it.
There's
in like a way.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
But I feel like, I don't know. I'm also from New England, so I just feel like that's overdone. Like, I get it. New Englanders are generally sad. but I don't know. I'll wait for it. I just wasn't about to pay the $15 to go see it IRL.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think people are going to really, really like it, and that's great. It's not one of my favorite movies of the year, but that's okay. It doesn't have to be. Last week, so we've gotten like some screeners to the house because it's that time of year where we have to vote for stuff. And so I have this stack of movies, several of which, you know, are supposed to be great, and I'm really excited to see them, but it was late. And my wife and I were tired, and it was like, boy, do we feel like watching something super heavy tonight? No. So let's watch our screener of The Girl on the Train, starring Emily Blunt. And that is a real piece of shit. the trailers all made it look like...
Expecting literally anything else, though.
No, I wasn't. But I don't think I was ready for, like, how bad it was. You know what I mean? Like, I was expecting a basic level of competence that I just was not interested in. this
like
movie,
it was a movie.
Like what?
It was a movie, and like that's it.
Yeah, exactly. And this was somehow even worse than that. And like Gone Girl, which is the film that it is so slavishly attempting to sort of replicate, I think it has a lot of really fucked up things to say about gender and gender relations. And I think some of it thinks that it's saying, but I think a lot of it, like Gone Girl, is unintentional. Like, I will struggle forever with my feelings about Gone Girl, because I get that it's a watchable movie, but I think it's saying some really dark things, and not the things that it thinks it's saying. I'm not even talking about, you know, the female character who's this monster, but that's not even what I'm talking about. And this movie, it has all these weird, disturbing messages that are unintentional, and then wraps them up in like this dumb potboiler thriller, and it's real garbage.
Oh no, I did like Gone Girl, but I think that's just because I don't like Ben Affleck, and I was totally fine watching him suffer for 2 hours. But it wasn't like, I don't know, I guess I didn't make it like a gendery thing. I just like, she's pretty and she was like being awful.
Yeah, but I,
what are your feelings?
I feel like the movie really comes down on Ben Affleck's side, to the point where every woman in his life, his sister, his mother, I mean, it's constantly referenced, all the ways that women have controlled and manipulated him. And some of it's just throwaway stuff. Like, there's one central relationship that we're supposed to look at and say, okay, this is the really toxic thing. But there's all these throwaway mentions to these other relationships that I don't know. I just think that's a movie that has some real problems with women, and again, not the ones that I think are on the surface that everyone was talking about after the movie came out. Again, it's well made, it's super watchable, but I just think it says some fucked up things that I don't know that David Fincher realized he was saying, but I think he's a guy who has some issues with humanity.
That's fair.
Two more quickly. One I won't even say that much about. I had emailed you about it a little bit, and that is Paul Verhoeven's latest film, Elle. It's a French film that stars Isabelle Huppert, a woman who is, this is not a spoiler, sexually assaulted in the opening minutes of the film. And then it spends a little over 2 hours kind of following her and what happens in the wake of that as she goes on with her life and attempts to discover who may have been the person responsible. She thinks it's someone that she knows. I will never sort out my feelings about this movie ever. And I don't even care to at this point. Like, again, it is well made. Isabelle Huppert gives a great performance, like one of the best performances I've seen this year in a movie that I cannot reconcile in my head. And I know that Paul Verhoeven prides himself on pushing buttons and on being sort of a provocateur. And I know that he's made a movie that says some things that may be considered unpopular by some. And I think he's doing it on purpose, but I don't know. I haven't read that many reviews of the film, right? But I've read several from men who are like, this movie's really good and interesting, and it's saying this, this, and this. And the few reviews that I've read from female critics all really don't like it. Now, there may be plenty of female critics who do like it, and I just haven't read their reviews, so I'm not trying to say every female critic hates this movie, just the ones that I have read. And I think that's telling.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say when I was like not into the like vibe, because I did a little digging on like what it was about and who was saying what about it.
Yeah.
It was like, it's a provocative movie that's using like a woman's storyline to be provocative so that like dudes see that it's provocative so they could write about how provocative it is. Like, I'm all set on that, I guess. Like, it doesn't add anything new to that, I guess, experience for me.
No, I don't think that it does. I think, you know, if someone was going to write a book about, like, rape revenge films, maybe this would get a little section, but does anyone need to write that book? I don't know. Maybe somebody will, but does somebody want to read that book? I don't know. Maybe somebody does, but I'm very conflicted. I mean, I'm not really. Like, it's a well-made movie, a well-acted movie that, again, I just have some real problems with. And I know that I'm supposed to have those problems, but there's something... I think in the email I was comparing it to Antichrist. Yeah, because again, that's a movie that's really trying to push buttons. But I think for me, Lars von Trier is kind of like attempting to start a dialogue, even if it's just a dialogue with himself. And I think L is a little bit self-satisfied in the way that it is kind of a closed loop. I don't think it exists to necessarily start a dialogue. I think the dialogue is like, what's he trying to say? And then if you can answer that, then there's no more conversation to be had. So,
sure.
I don't know. And then the last movie I'll mention is that I rewatched David Cronenberg's fourth movie, Rabid.
Which, I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's from the late 70s. Still when he was making films in Canada. Scream Factory just put it out on Blu-ray. Again, you wouldn't know. You don't own physical media. But Scream Factory just put it out on Blu-ray. And this is the movie with former adult film star Marilyn Chambers in sort of her first mainstream role. She's in a car accident. She gets a radically experimental surgery, and it turns out that she develops like an armpit vagina, and then a penis thing comes out of it, and it's like a vampiric penis, and she has to stab people with her armpit penis that comes out of her armpit vagina and suck their blood. And then when she does that, it kind of turns them into vampires. And so before long, the entire city is overrun with these sort of vampire zombies. It's interesting because it's real rough. You know, he was still in the early stages of making movies. And so he has these ideas. He's not able to totally execute them yet. And in a lot of ways, he's reworking a lot of the same ideas that he had already explored with Shivers, which was his second movie, which is also kind of about this sort of sexually transmitted outbreak that happens in this apartment complex. So I think it'll be an interesting complement to some of our conversation about Existenz. I don't think all of it works, but just as a David Cronenberg fan and as somebody who likes to sort of chart the progress of his career, I think it's a very interesting early step towards some of the things that he would continue to explore in his career.
It's funny. So I was like poking around, just like bringing it, I guess, to Existenz, like on what people have said about the movie and just in like progression. They're like saying that Existenz is to Cronenberg as like 8.5 is to Fellini, which to me is like one, the douchiest sentence I've ever read in my entire life. But two, I guess that they feel that this is like his, you know, the pinnacle of his like oeuvre or something.
I don't even know if I agree with that. So let's jump into Existenz. I think originally we were trying to come up with a movie to talk about, and I think you had thrown out Existenz because you were on like a kind of a Cronenberg jag.
I feel like I'm usually on a Cronenberg jag.
Well, then you need to see Rabid because your life is pitifully short on armpit vaginas and armpit penises.
You know, I've always thought that.
Yeah.
So it's time.
That's your jam. So what was it about Existenz that was like, I want to talk about this?
I think it's just one of those things that the movie is, sure, very Cronenberg, very body, like squishy. but it's also like very funny and it knows it is. Whereas like with Crash, which I watched recently to try and like wrap my brain around his movies, is like not funny and it's just weird and the whole thing makes me super uncomfortable. Or like you're laughing when it doesn't feel like you're supposed to laugh. But I think that like the video game media lends itself so well to this like sort of alien way that he wants to write characters. So it's like these people have, you know, they talk like they've just learned how to make like voice happen. And I feel like that about most of his movies. And it's just like in Existence, it makes so much sense with like that sort of non sequitur of gameplay. Like you'll be playing, I was never a video game person, but I watched video games, but it'll be like action, action, action. And then it'll be this random ass line that doesn't fit. And I think that that is perfectly captured in this movie. Now, so I don't know. It's got a lot of things to it.
I agree that it has a lot of things to it. I think anybody who's sort of saying that this is, you know, the pinnacle of Cronenberg, I mean, in some ways, I think it's because he's repeating a lot of the same ideas he's sort of introduced elsewhere. So to me, it's kind of Cronenberg riffing on something that he's already done. And I still enjoy the movie. But I'm interested that you read the dialogue as being deliberately stylized that way, because as I was watching it, and I'm not a video game person either. I was kind of hoping you were, because I felt like one of us should be, being that this is a movie about video games. As I was watching it, it struck me, a lot of the weird artificial dialogue struck me a little bit as like a guy trying to approximate how he thinks gamers would talk about, like, we gotta jack in, without really being familiar with video games. And I think, you know, Cronenberg's, one of the curses of David Cronenberg, and one of the, you know, things that makes him such a genius, is that he's often like 10 years ahead of everyone else. And so even when he makes Existenz, I think he's dealing with things that we are just now, and this movie's, you know, almost 20 years old at this point. It's more than 15 years old, that we are just now sort of starting to encounter for real, you know, in terms of virtual reality or whatever. This is almost like the first year where virtual reality seems like it might actually start to be a thing.
Sure.
It has been, you know, people have tried to predict it, and the 90s were big on like anyone who saw The Lawnmower Man or Disclosure. Just like movies about computers in the 90s are hilarious because they got everything wrong, but they were just predicting like, well, we think it's going to be like this. And so Cronenberg is kind of predicting this one thing. And I think he's, you know, closer than a lot of other filmmakers got. So he's working so far ahead that I think he's having to invent some of his own sort of gaming culture, and the way that he does it to me rings a little bit false. I don't mind because it's part of this movie's universe, and so I'm able to just go along with the stylization of the dialogue. But I read it a totally different way, so I think that's interesting that you think that it was a deliberate choice that he made.
Well, can we assume people have watched this movie? Can I ruin
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
All right, so there's multiple layers of gameplay, duh. But I think the thing that made me feel like it was on purpose was the last little bit where they're, like, with the headpieces on in the, like, last, oh, they're no longer in a game anymore.
Right.
And you see, like, what is it, Christopher Eccleston's character being, like, very earnestly talking about how, like, I was really good in the first, like, you know, 30 seconds, and then it was just kind of boring. I think that his delivery was so disappointed and like genuinely disappointed, because he basically had to watch a video game for what felt like days. So that sounds terrible.
Right.
But I think that just, I mean, minus the Jude Law, Jennifer Jason Leigh, like death to pilgrimage kind of business at the end, there were certain parts that felt very natural. And I think that there was like a little bit more of a contrast for me.
Okay.
It's
a weird, because as I watched the movie, and it had been years since I had last watched it, and I think it's super interesting that this movie comes out, I feel like a few weeks after The Matrix. In my brain, it was before The Matrix, but I think it was actually a few weeks after, because it's dealing with so many of the same ideas in terms of, like, which level of reality are we in? Is this the virtual one? Are we now in the real world? And a little bit of, like, cursory Googling before we recorded, I found some people trying to interpret the last scene. Are they actually in reality? Because it's suggested that maybe they're not, you know, when that the last line of the movie basically is like, wait, this is still a game, right? And so that's, I mean, that's Cronenberg just blowing our minds, man.
I love how many, like, theories there are about this movie. Like that one scene where they're in the trout farm factory or whatever fish farm it is.
Yeah.
And Allegra goes and picks up that meaty flesh bit and, like, turns to Jude Law and's like, I saw that you made contact. And then he doesn't deliver, I guess, the correct line of dialogue. So she does it again. There is literally, like, pages on the internet about that one exchange.
Really?
Talking about how, like, none of the characters are real. It's Jude Law just playing by himself. It goes into this, like, totally cuckoo bananas territory, which I think doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Well, and that's the thing. It's like, this is a movie that certainly invites some of that, because it is a little bit ambiguous in terms of, hey, what's real, what's not. There are things to interpret because it's a David Cronenberg movie, and there's always going to be things to interpret, which is why he's great. But I do think that sort of post-Inception, now there's this idea on the part of every audience member that all filmmakers are constantly trying to trick us, that they are all films are puzzled to be solved. And when there are no textual clues to suggest that something is not real, something is a fantasy, that all of a sudden people are like, no, none of it's really happening. Don't you see? I remember this when The Dark Knight Rises came out, because that was, I think, Christopher Nolan's first movie post Inception. And everyone's like, no, man, the whole thing at the end, that's a dream. That's the, it's like, there is no evidence.
What's that? That was the first of the new Batman.
That was the final of the new Batman.
All right. Got it. Okay. I'm bored.
It was his first, post Inception, his last Batman movie. And there's all this interpretation about, like, what's real and what's a dream, because the guy had made Inception. It's like, well, he's not bringing that to every single movie. There's no reason. There's no evidence in this film to suggest that any of what you're seeing isn't just on the level and straightforward. And yet, and so there's a little bit of that now with even older movies, where now we go back and we have to, like, do the Inception on them and say, like, oh, well, what's this? And what's, you know, is this really happening? Here's the thing. I mean, Jude Law is totally fine in the movie, and he's kind of like playing like a dork, which is kind of fun because he's, you know, Mr. Handsome, Charming Jude Law. And he's really kind of a vanilla dork, you know, even his name, Ted Peichel, is like not cool. But he is performing, he's acting in one movie, and Jennifer Jason Leigh is acting in a very different movie. And, oh. No, go ahead.
No, that's just interesting. I just reacted.
Oh, okay. some of that is just, that's always what you're going to get with Jennifer Jason Leigh, especially when there's some other weirdness in the movie for her to lean into. If she's, you know, just starring in like a straight ahead drama, she's going to do the straight ahead drama. But if there's any weirdness for her to lean into, like, she's going to do it. And she really does. And so it's not just the dialogue that ends up being stylized. It's also her kind of performance. And it's her performance seems informed by the fact that she kind of knows that she's in a game the whole time. Whereas I think Jude Law's, and maybe, again, this is by design because he is the audience surrogate, maybe he knew that he had to be the one to make those reveals. His performance had to be the one to reveal those levels of reality. So when he does turn at the end, it has to be a genuine surprise, you know. But he seems to not know where things are going. I'm talking Jude Law, the actor. I'm not talking about Ted Peichel, the character. Jude Law, the actor, seems to not know where things are going necessarily, whereas Jennifer Jason Leigh does.
Well, he's just so like gentle, I want to say. I like found this, this was months ago, but I found this like abstract for a dissertation and I want to find out who read it because I want her to be my bride. But it was basically like how Cronenberg's movies like exaggerate heterosexual couple dynamics so much in movies to like a parody level. And in Existenz, you've got Jude Law in the role of like the damsel in distress and you have Allegra Geller playing the like kind of hard body like dude. So it sort of seems like she's got this like, she's extremely like aggressive the entire movie, I feel. But she's like doing it in a way that feels very like cartoonish. And him as like, he is also doing that. But it's just like in the DVD commentary, which I mentioned I listened to, Cronenberg mentions that like almost every single scene between the two of them is supposed to connote some sort of sex scene.
Okay. Every single scene.
Literally every single one.
I mean, there's a few where I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. It's sure. Unmistakable. But I don't know. Does he elaborate at all on some of the others?
I'm wondering if he's just like dropping that in for fun. But he talked about the like scenes where, you know, she's porting him in and like that being the more like tender, gentle, like scenes as the two of them like get closer, and also like contrasting that with like the scene with like Willem Dafoe's character where he's just like, you know, he manhandles him a little bit.
Right.
And that has been described as like a rape scene, even though like Cronenberg in the commentary is like, no, that's super consensual. You can see that it's just like rougher. But he was like saying that people had been asking him years after the movie had been made, like, are you aware of the like homosexual overtones in this scene? And he's like, yeah, duh, I wrote it.
Yeah, I don't think that one went over his head.
No.
as Willem Dafoe, you know, flips Jude Law over and penetrates him. I think Cronenberg knew what he was writing there. That's really, that gender dynamic thing is really interesting because now I'm immediately going back to like a lot of his early films, and that's absolutely true. And in some cases, it's kind of ugly. Have you seen The Brood?
I saw parts of it, but honestly, it got a little like, it was a little too much for me. I was a little too much of a weenie for that.
It's a fucked up movie. And it was one that he made during his divorce. And I think the divorce was fairly contentious. And the movie is entirely about his divorce. And it's really all up on the screen. But in terms of that idea of those gender dynamics, I think The Brood is really kind of ugly in terms of some of its ideas about women. So maybe Existenz shows, you know, a Cronenberg who has evolved or softened in some of those feelings, because I don't think Existenz is misogynist.
No, I don't think so either.
I'm like, as I'm saying it, I'm like, I'm trying to think of scenes that I'm like, is it? But it's not, right? I mean, it's...
No. If anything, it's like you've got, not that like this would be the thing that would, you know, be the thing that like misogyny is predicated on, but like she's got kind of the upper hand in like almost every single scene, minus the one where like his game character takes over and he like licks her porthole, which is a sentence I've never said out loud. And like she kind of elbows him away and he's like, oh, it was my game character, I lost control, which is like, all right, Jude Law.
But that like, line has never worked for me, by the way. Never.
No, it's cool, it was my game character. That's very funny. So yeah, like that's the only scene where she, that and when he's cutting the umbi cord.
Yeah.
When she's poured it into the diseased pod. Those right. are the only two times that she's like the vulnerable one.
Right. But even the degree to which it makes her the aggressor or puts her in charge isn't in a way that is sort of being, she's not, it's not painting her as like the controlling bitch, you know, the way that some movies will do. That's not what he's after.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, which I like. I had thought of something that I want to say about that scene where he's licking her board. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to say about some of that stuff.
That's a good scene.
If, I mean, again, God bless Cronenberg, who just will show you things you've never seen in a movie ever. And one of the reviews that I read was kind of describing things that happen in the movie, you know, kind of going through the plot, and it gets near the end and it says, like, quick reminder, this is a movie that played in malls, which I thought was very funny because, yeah, this movie got a wide release.
Can like, you imagine going to this with your parents?
Right.
Oh my God.
So I'm just wondering, I guess, because, you know, sex is something that is always very fascinating to Cronenberg. I mean, he's just interested in all sort of the systems of the body and sex as a function of the body. But what, I mean, do you have a read on like what he's trying to say about the relationship? Because if he's saying every scene between them is meant to connote some sort of sex, what then is the relationship between sex and gaming?
I wonder if it's some sort of like, I don't know. I feel like it's like almost a fetishization of reality in sort of like in that way that like Second Life is so interesting to certain people because it is this whole world that's separated from your own reality. And you can kind of like penetrate that realm as whoever you want to be, if that makes sense. And if you've got all of these like realities housed inside of each other in this movie, and they're all kind of like bleeding into one another, maybe it's not sex in like romantic or like a gratification way, but like a physical, there's an inside and an outside kind of thing. Because you see it with like the gun from the first scene ends up being the thing that makes you realize that the scene one is inside a game anyway.
Right.
And it's not until you get to the very end when, like, the technology isn't fleshy anymore and the guns aren't, like, bodily anymore that, like, we've kind of come out of the experience. So it feels like it's, like, multi-layered penetration party.
Which right? was the original title for the movie, Multi-Layered Penetration Party. And they're like, what about existence?
So I feel like it's less like, you know, for gratification and more the like physical part of it.
Is it meant to be some sort of function of the fact that they are, when we get to the outside world, it's suggested that they are a couple, yes?
Yeah.
And so is that just their, you know, unconscious minds or, you know, the them playing the game, like sort of working towards their natural state, which is in real life, they're a couple. And so in gameplay, they slowly like gravitate towards being a sexually active couple. I don't know. I don't know.
Which, I mean, real talk for a second.
Real talk. Good.
So we've got the real couple in a room full of people who are in the game that for all intents and purposes, they're watching this go down.
Yeah.
If you're in a focus group and you're like, have just realized that like 10 other people have basically watched you like digitally have cyber intercourse with your partner, like I would very quietly get up and leave that focus group because that is so embarrassing.
For Ted and Allegra, you're saying?
Yeah. Like if, because I think that the way that the conversation at the end, like the actual game creator, what was his name? Like Nevgeny, I can't pronounce it.
Yeah.
Was saying that like their brains kind of tainted the whole experience. Like they basically just like forced 10 people to watch them do it.
That's what they're into, man.
Oh my gosh, this is Crash all over again.
Is it, but at the same time, like, don't they kind of know? where this is all going. So who cares? Like, what do they have to be embarrassed about? They know at the end of this, they're getting up and shooting people.
Sure. I guess that would probably curtail the embarrassment factor. I don't know. I've never held a gun. I don't really feel.
No, me either.
But when I realized that, I was like, holy shit.
I think it's like more embarrassing for the other people who are like, do we seriously need to, why are we here? What are we doing here?
Can we unport? This is awkward.
Right. I'm just going to grab a soda. I'm going to come back when you guys are done. This is really kind of weird. So many ways, obviously, this movie is kind of a reworking of Videodrome, which I won't argue is the best Cronenberg, but is still my favorite Cronenberg movie. And the one that is like so insanely ahead of its time, even though it's now talking about exclusively technologies that do not exist. And so anyone watching it now would be like, what is this thing they keep putting in James Wood's stomach vagina? Like, what is that? Well, that's a VHS tape, son. What's a VHS tape? Really? You're not asking me what's a stomach vagina? my son asks all the wrong questions. So this is in many ways a reworking of a lot of those same ideas. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was in Videodrome, it's very much about technology, external technology that we are internalizing, right? I mean, sometimes literally in the scene where, you know, a hand stuffs a VHS tape in James Wood's stomach vagina. Whereas in Existenz, I mean, there's still that idea of being penetrated by technology, obviously, but it's almost like now technology has become an organic extension of us. So now, rather than like cold plastic technology being forced into us, we are forcing our bodies over technology. Do you know what I mean? Like we are covering this game pod in a fleshy sack, you know, that is our body. So now we are sort of the ones who are, we are no longer the slave to the technology. We have now become sort of masters over it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it super does. I mean, it's like, not to, you know, bring it to like Douche Town, but like
Douche Town is the name of our upcoming podcast, the Morning Zoo edition of the podcast.
Yes.
Welcome to Douche Town.
Coming at you live from NYC. So in like the fine arty realm around the same time of the 90s, you have like artists like Stellark who were implanting like silicone into their skin and stuff. So like that was such an intense conversation in fine art that it like makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I guess Existenz makes sense to me because of what I have studied. Like you have, I don't know if that makes sense. I guess it was like a big fear that we were spending so much time with our tech that it was becoming us. Mm-hmm. And now that's literally a thing, which is cool. So yeah, I get the flesh enveloping makes sense.
I just thought that was, yeah, I thought that was interesting. And again, that everything in this fake world is this weird biological extension of ourselves, where our guns are made out of organic material. The bullets are teeth, you know, we're not, nothing is like inorganic really, but then that's revealed to be a false reality.
Hmm.
So what's that saying? That like, I mean, obviously on just a storytelling level, it's like, well, that's the proof that this isn't real. That's what differentiates reality from gameplay, right? But in terms of like the thematics of the movie, I wonder what is being said there.
Do you think there's more morality or like a question of ethics in that situation? Because like, I think the thing that is interesting about having like a weapon made out of animals that like Jude Law had to eat was that it was such a purposeful attack at that point, that it's not like this very quickly produced gun that you see at the end that like is quick and kind of without thought. So you've got the like game pieces at the end, which are like smooth plastic, purple, not at all of our bodies. So it's kind of like we're tourists in that realm. Right. Whereas in like the deeper layers of gameplay, you've got things that are like of our bodies, of things that were caught and like mutated and cut up. It just like, I think it brings a lot more responsibility to the table.
That's interesting. Yeah, I did not think of that.
I didn't until just now either.
Well, see, this is the fun of having these conversations.
We're learning.
And the thing about Existenz is, you know, Cronenberg makes these movies that so many people describe as like icky, you know. There's very little in Existenz that is graphically violent. There are certainly those moments, you know, when he shoots the guy in the fish house or whatever. There are certainly those moments of bloodshed or whatever, but it's not that it's violent. It's just that it's gross, you know, like the game pods are gross looking and right. The whole porting thing, like it's all gross. I don't know. Like it's not that what you're being shown is like, oh, disgusting. It's a head cut off or a body melting or something. You know, he's done those moments that are truly gory and nasty. This movie isn't that though. And yet there's more just pulsating flesh and like weird gross shit in this movie than in so many of his other movies.
Yeah, I wonder if that makes it grosser, because sometimes with the violence you can kind of like tune it out because it's something that you haven't seen in real life. Not that you've seen like portholes and shit in real life, but it's like not that far of a departure. Like it feels almost possible.
Right.
Like we're all meat sacks. It's kind of gross.
Right. I start to get upset whenever I think about that. this is probably revealing too much, but like if I'm holding one of my kids and I put my hand over like my daughter's heart and I feel her heartbeat, I start to have a panic attack because I realize like, oh, she's just so vulnerable. Like any one of these things could stop working. And it sends me into such a panic that that I throw her down on the ground. I don't know. I have a hard time dealing with like,
for you.
And maybe that's why Cronenberg is so effective for me, because I have such a hard time reconciling like just how fragile our bodies actually are, and his movies work on that idea so much. Existenz,
they remind us that we're bodies.
Yeah, right. I mean, Existenz not quite as much. And yet, you know, there's all this just gross stuff in there that is like, yeah, that's what that would look like, this weird fleshy game pod. I also think it's interesting, this, if I'm not mistaken, is his first movie post-Crash, yes?
I don't know.
I think so. This is 99, Crash is 96, unless I'm forgetting one, but I don't think I am. And Crash, again, being about this relationship between not just sex and cars, but the organic and the inorganic. And it's, you know, people who, not that cars are technology, but let's call it a variation on technology, because that's sort of Cronenberg's thing, is this, you know, technology representing the inorganic. That it's about, you know, these people who are turned on by car crashes, the twisting of the metal, blah, blah, blah. They get in cars and they have to fuck each other. And so now in Existenz, he kind of takes it a step further, where now it's like we don't have to, not only do we get to fuck in our technology, but we get to get fucked by our technology. Like it would basically, you know what I mean? It's like, it would basically be like if, you know, James Spader, there's no, not to be indelicate, but like, you know, sat on the gear shift in Crash, you know, or something like, it's such an extension. By the way, the night I saw Crash opening night, and I went to see Liar Liar by myself and then walked over to see Crash by myself. So that was a weird double feature. And I walked in.
Weird double feature.
It was. I walked into Crash And I sat down and I was like, oh no, because I realized it was me and like 10 other dudes all alone. Like there was no one there with a partner. Everyone was by themselves. And
like
part
no eye contact.
Right. Well, and part of me is like, so is that maybe it's not a sex thing. Like the part that was I was trying to rationalize in my head was like, well, this is not a sex thing. This isn't like these guys aren't here to masturbate to this David Cronenberg movie. I hope because they're doing it wrong.
Did they have any facial scars?
Right,
sure?
Exactly. But maybe it was like the same situation that I was in, which is like, no one will come see this movie with these people. We all have to see this alone because who are we going to get to come to this movie? So that's how I rationalized that.
Yeah, I feel like that's a movie that's way better watched alone because I feel like, I don't know, I watched it by myself, but like in my home, which was less awkward, I imagine. Like, I feel like it's one of those awkward moments that like you're mutually judging the other person's reaction to any scene of that movie. Like none of that movie sat okay with me. Not like morally, just like a, oh, I never thought of it this way, and this makes me uncomfortable.
Right, right. Well, and you would constantly have to be, like, talking or cracking jokes just to, like, not feel weird, you know? Like,
like imagine holding hands during that movie. Nope. No, thank you.
Existenz, on the other hand, very romantic.
My boyfriend and we walked out because it's in the theater. That movie is so intense.
Existenz or Crash?
Existenz.
Oh yeah.
Like I had only seen it like, you know, many times at home on a computer, but on the big screen with surround sound, that's a very like indoors movie. That is just, yeah, it's extremely visceral.
that's a good word for it. Visceral. I feel like it's messier than a lot of Cronenberg movies. And again, I wonder how much of that is by design because it is taking place inside a world that is very messy. You know, the guns are mess. Everything's messy. It has just kind of a dirty feel to it. And I don't mean like dirty, like in the Puritan sense. I mean like actually covered in a layer of dirt.
Yeah, and you get that in the trout farm. Like, when he picks up the knife to cut her umbi cord, like everything is already covered in gross blood.
Yeah. It's just, everything's kind of gross and brown. And it's just that kind of a movie. But I also feel like it's just a little bit sloppier. And I wonder, you know, because going back to Rabid, there was a lot of that. It's kind of a messy, sloppy movie. And so Cronenberg certainly has that in him. It's like some of his work from about the mid 80s on through Crash, because of Crash, because of Dead Ringers, because of maybe The Fly, we started to associate Cronenberg with like cold, clinical kind of perfection. At least I did. And I think there's that side of him, you know, the purely cerebral side, and he's made movies like that. But Existenz comes more from, there's certainly those cerebral elements, but it comes much more from that kind of old school Cronenberg, which, like you said, is a lot more about the visceral than the cerebral. And Existenz, like Videodrome, which is one of the reasons I like both those movies so much, is that they are a really nice kind of marriage between the two.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to like think of how clean some of his movies are and how clean his son's movie is.
Your favorite.
Which is Antiviral.
Antiviral. With your
which
boy.
Which is just a clean up. He's so pretty. He's so pretty. Which is wrong casting for anyone with the last name Cronenberg. It's also funny to think just like remembering that The Matrix is so similar in theme to think of how different the styling is.
Yeah.
Like obviously made by different people. But in like The Matrix, you have almost all of their bodies are covered and it's more about their brains. And here it's just like their inside brains, but they're all about bodies. I don't know. It's gross. I think it has to be yucky.
Well, and The Matrix is made by people who are clearly all about video games, and so many of their subsequent films have been informed by, you know, video game aesthetics and video game language. And so the way that they approach these concepts is to explore them as a video game, as a kung fu film, and where you're a first-person shooter, you're running around shooting everyone, you know, big, elaborate fight scenes and special effects and stuff like that. And Cronenberg, again, does not strike me as someone who really plays video games. He's more fascinated by them as an idea, as a way of altering our reality or experiencing a different reality in the way that he was looking at, you know, TV in Videodrome, you know, 15, 16 years earlier. He's now kind of exploring a lot of these same ideas, but with video games. And that's kind of why I feel like Existenz is a movie that was maybe like 5 to 10 years too early. And maybe I'm wrong about this, because there will be people who have played video games their entire lives and they're like, no, they were always a thing. But in my brain, like, true hardcore gaming culture didn't really like explode until like the 2000s. And I wonder if that's just the proliferation of the internet. And so it became a thing where like everyone could connect with one another, you know, over their shared love of video games or whatever. As somebody who's removed from it, I don't know what I'm talking about. So I know there are people listening right now who are like, what? No, you're stupid. Because
but
I know
Cronenberg does either.
Maybe. Yeah. So I just feel like had this movie been made 5 or 10 years later, I think it actually would have been a lot better informed in terms of some of the gaming aspects. I don't know that it would be a different movie, because I don't think that Cronenberg's primary interest is to really talk about the gaming experience. I think, again, he's more interested in our relationship to technology, once again, and the ways in which we try to alter our own realities, you know, through some form of media.
Yeah, I mean, he, like, sort of going down the line of, like, what company housed what thing, is you've got, like, Pilgrimage, which is holding the game Transcendence, which is holding Antenna, which is holding Existenz. So you have like a religion to entertainment, like one-to-one
right.
thing. It doesn't feel very video gamey. It feels more like, because in the commentary, he's talking about Heidegger. Like that's not PlayStation.
Like Heidegger was a huge influence on Grand Theft Auto. So just make sure you know your shit before.
The power of free will and Grand Theft Auto, my future thesis.
You could totally write a sweet think piece about that.
Oh my God. And submit it to like Medium, maybe Jezebel. Sorry, I'm the worst.
Are you a Jennifer Jason Leigh fan?
I don't really know much about her. I'm a fan of her hair changes in this movie, but like, I can't like think off the top of my head anything else that she's in.
Okay.
That I like.
All right.
Is that?
No, that's fine. I am just such a fan of her, and she's a huge weirdo. And I think part of why I'm such a fan of hers. Did you see The Hateful Eight?
Oh, shut up! She is in that movie.
She is,
I
in
like
fact,
and
I like it too. Did you ever see
get much love, but what? I liked it.
What's that?
The Hateful Eight didn't get much love, but I did like it.
No, and that's a crime. Did you ever see In the Cut?
I did not.
You should see that movie. I would be fascinated to have a conversation with you about that movie.
Okay.
Jane Campion, it's a mess, but it's interesting. Did you ever see, I mean, I'm not just going to name a bunch of Jennifer Jason Leigh movies, but Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle?
No.
Okay, that's another one I think you should check out.
Okay.
The Hudsucker Proxy, the Coen Brothers movie?
Nope.
Okay, so that's the movie where I think I officially fell in love with Jennifer Jason Leigh. I was a fan of her already just from like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, or even like Backdraft, where she's kind of miscast, or Rush, or Miami Blues. She's awesome in Miami Blues. But Hudsucker Proxy was the movie where I really fell in love with her, because Hudsucker Proxy is very much kind of this throwback to 1930s and 40s screwball comedy. And Jennifer Jason Leigh makes a big choice acting wise and does all of her dialogue in this sort of very rapid fire sort of Katharine Hepburn-esque cadence. And it's the kind of thing that is going to really put off 75% of the audience, and then 25% are going to be like, what is she doing? That is great. It was sort of my reaction to some old Nicolas Cage performances before he became bored with everything and I became bored with him. But he made just such big choices that I was like, oh, this guy is fascinating. So Jennifer Jason Leigh, if I had to name like a favorite female actor, that was always who I named. And that's a big part of, I think, why I like this movie, is because I like, at times I can't figure out if she's miscast. And then at times I feel like, oh, she's the one who knows the movie she's in more than anyone else. And maybe that's not fair, but the performances are so weirdly stylized, because you have Ian Holm doing that weird cartoonish accent, and you have Don McKellar doing that weird cartoonish accent. And
which they comment on at the end of the movie.
Right.
So they do know that they're being absolutely insane.
Exactly. But I think that's a hard thing for people to grasp as they watch it. I think it's a thing that's going to push people out of the movie, because they're like, what is this? The acting is so bad, without being patient enough to see, okay, but if you get to the end, you realize that that's a deliberate choice, both within the narrative and made by the filmmaker and these actors, you know? So it's a weird, it's kind of a hard movie to get your head around, even as just a movie watching experience.
That's fair, because it doesn't like give you any clues into the formatting until like a good third of the way through. I think you kind of get used to it. Like, it's got that, you know, reading Clockwork Orange, getting used to the way that it's written kind of vibe
to it. Right. I feel like in 1999, this happened somewhere. Oh, I remember. It was The Sixth Sense came out, and you've seen The Sixth Sense.
I sure have.
Okay. And it's this huge, you know, phenomenon. It makes hundreds of millions of dollars. And then a very short time after, a movie called Stir of Echoes comes out. Have you ever seen Stir of Echoes?
That I have not.
Okay, no. Well, there you go. So it's Kevin Bacon as kind of this very blue-collar guy who starts seeing a ghost. He lives in Chicago. David Koepp wrote and directed it, and it's really good. And it just gets completely glossed over because this much slicker, more well-funded movie had come out right before it that kind of covered the same territory. And part of me feels like that's the situation with Existenz. I don't know that the movie would have, I don't think this movie was ever particularly commercially viable. And again, the fact that it got a wide release at all, it kind of blows my mind. But if not for The Matrix just a month prior, I wonder if this movie's reputation outside of Cronenberg fans would be different.
Yeah, because it's like you see more often than not it being compared to The Matrix. I don't know. I wonder if it could stand without that comparison, though.
I mean, for me it can, but
me too. But I mean, just like in the realm of talking about movies, like outside people who are both into Cronenberg. I mean, it's to your point. Like, would it exist outside of a Cronenberg fan circle?
Right. And then this is also, for me, the last, it's not the last like Cronenberg movie, but it's the last of this kind of Cronenberg movie, because in the 2000s, he gets into History of Violence, Eastern Promises, the one about the BDSM, Dangerous Method. And his career takes a kind of a different path. He's no longer making kind of the science fiction horror. Are you a fan of sort of the third act Cronenberg?
I honestly have avoided them, because if it's not like goopy, I'm not super into it. I think that was the thing that kind of attracted me superficially to his movies, were like, oh, practical special effects are really cool. This guy does it in almost every scene. Like, even in the commentary, he almost brags at to what degree everything was done in studio, like not digitally. So to go on to this new, I'm reluctant to begin that leg of this journey is what I want to say.
Some of them are good. I mean, I think A History of Violence is a good movie. Eastern Promises, I think, has some really good stuff in it. It's a movie that is held in very high regard by some, but so maybe I need to revisit it. Cosmopolis kind of left me cold. And then his last movie, Maps to the Stars, like, bummed me out really, really hard in that way that, like, oh, this guy was once great. And now he's making Maps to the Stars, which isn't to say it's all bad, because Julianne Moore is doing some crazy shit in that movie. And I respect that. And Mia Wasikowska is really good in it. So there are things to like about it. But Existenz for me is kind of the last page in a specific chapter in his career. And like you, that's the Cronenberg I'm most interested in. Those are the movies of his that I return to the most often. You know, I don't put on like M. Butterfly that often. I'm much quicker to watch The Fly or Videodrome or something like that. So it's always going to be kind of special for me in that way as well.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel like the same person anymore.
No.
Relationship ran its course for me, I think.
Sure. Got it. You guys just are taking some time apart. It's fine.
You know what? We'll figure it out. But
he may still have another one in him. We'll see. We'll see.
Bring back the goop.
Yeah. And by the goop, you mean Gwyneth Paltrow's e-newsletter, yes? Is that, or is Goop a website? I don't know what Goop is.
What? I mean, like, jelly viscous business.
No, of course I know you do.
I didn't know that this... Does she actually write words?
Well, no, it's... hold on. I'm actually going to look it up as we talk. She has a thing called Goop. I don't know what... I don't understand what it is. Hold on. I'm looking it up right now.
I feel like the last person we need to hear more words from is Gwyneth Paltrow.
A weekly... Okay, so if I Google search it, the description is... A weekly lifestyle publication curated by Gwyneth Paltrow, offering exclusive collaborations, recipes, travel notes, and more.
Oh my God.
Goop.
I feel like this is an instance where I'm like not upset if the internet decides to censor that publication. Like, I don't need Gwyneth Paltrow telling me how to live my life.
You don't want her to curate your holiday shopping, because guess is everything on here costs at least $10,000.
I bet, like, in earnest, her stocking stuffers are like cans of flavored oxygen. I don't trust the woman at all.
So what if you could live in the Existenz reality, except you had to live inside Goop.
Inside the publication?
Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle blog.
Oh my God. I'm trying to like bargain to make this like cool. I feel like I couldn't do it, but I want to watch someone else do it and not Gwyneth Paltrow.
I so don't want this episode of the podcast to go down this path, but now I've done it because I pulled up Goop and I clicked on her holiday shopping guide. And I clicked on the Lover Gift Guide, and I found the first item are Alexander McQueen leather gloves for $765.
Merry Christmas, Erica. There it is.
Red Decker white ostrich feather duster, $45. Oh. Which, by the way, like, what? Why is that? What is with the... Why is feather dust... Well, anyway, whatever. This is a different conversation.
What were we talking about again?
Why is that on the same page with like lingerie and like $165 pasties? Oh my God.
I feel like this is now back to Cronenberg.
Yeah, hold on. I have to just stick something else in my stomach vagina and get off of the Goop page. All right, I closed that.
I was about to ask, is there any stomach vaginas for sale?
There are, but they're satin lined and they're $1,200.
No, I'm really into silk. Damn it.
Anything else that you want to bring up about Existenz?
It's a great movie. Go watch it.
Where does this rank in terms of like the Cronenbergs that you have seen?
I still think this is my favorite.
Oh, okay.
I do. I think like I've written about The Fly for the blog and everything, but I just, this one's so goofy and Jude Law is so pretty. It's my fave.
He is pretty and his hair had not started falling out yet. So,
oh, but he did bald very gracefully.
Sure. Yeah.
Just, you know, good for him.
Yes, absolutely good for him. This was his year, though, because this same year he was in The Talented Mr. Ripley, and he is pretty incredible in that movie.
I think the last thing I saw him in was like an alcohol commercial, so I am out of the loop with Mr. Law.
I don't know what else he's done lately either.
I think the last thing I saw, like, genuinely was, like, Repo Man. He's in that, right?
He is, and that's a movie that owes, I think, something to Cronenberg. I don't love the movie, but I think there are some elements of Cronenbergian dystopia in that movie.
That's real. And organs? Oh, wait. Here's my outro thought.
Yeah.
Okay. So, imagine that Existenz is the prequel to Gattaca.
Okay.
Because
this is how Ted Peichel loses use of his legs.
This is how Ted Peichel loses. Yes, done.
From his porting operation.
Yes, it makes sense, kind of.
Do you feel like that scene where he gets the port? Do you feel like there might be some like super subtle homosexual overtones going on there? I mean,
whoa!
I don't want to read too deep into things.
I think that you might be projecting. That's way off.
Thank you very much for talking Existenz. It was exactly as much fun as I thought it would be.
Oh my gosh, it has been an absolute pleasure.
It has. Both Kate and I will be starting a gift registry on Goop. So if you want to get us anything for the upcoming holidays, any ostrich feather duster will do for me. I can stick it right in my port. And the house will be clean all year long. So that's very exciting. But thank you very much. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. We're posting stuff every day. You can find our podcast in iTunes or on Stitcher, wherever you find your podcasts. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at fthismovie. Or you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for talking Existenz with me, Kate.
It's been awesome.
And I will leave you all with this thought. Death to the demoness, Allegra Geller.
And catch us on Morning Zoo.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.